The International Atomic Energy Agency is on its way to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant as shelling in the vicinity continues.
You know, these operations are very complex operations. We are going to a war zone. We are going to occupy territory.
Plus, the world reacts to the death of former Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev.
I think for many Russians, and particularly since Putin came to power, they blame Gorbachev for the breakup of the Soviet Union. Much of what he stood for has now been reversed by Putin.
And later in the program, how those in the western state of Colorado came out to support Ukraine. Today is Wednesday, August 31st. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russia and Ukraine on Wednesday traded accusations of launching fresh strikes near a nuclear power plant in the southern region that has drawn international concern about the safety amid the conflict. The allegations from the two sides are the latest in weeks of finger-pointing regarding attacks near the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. They come as inspectors from the United Nations make their way toward the site to carry out safety and security checks. The team from the International Atomic Energy Agency departed Kyiv on Wednesday with IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi, saying that his team has received assurances that they will be able to carry out their work.
You know, these operations are very complex operations. We are going to a war zone. We are going to occupy territory. And this requires the explicit guarantees from not only from the Russian Federation, also from the Republic of Ukraine. And we have been able to secure that.
And joining us from Kyiv with additional details is reporter Anna Chernikova.
We got confirmation that they have arrived to the city of Zaporizhia in the afternoon. So apparently the next couple of days would be the days for the visit. However, we have some, you know, different information from the IAEA officials and from the Russian representation in the Enerhodar and the Zaporizhia power plant. So according to Rossi, they are planning to examine the real situation there and to help to stabilize the situation as much as possible. Also, according to him, the mission plans to spend several days at the station, including talking with the staff and reporting on the results of the trip. Oh, and also the organization intends to establish a permanent representation at the station. However, according to the so-called head of the Zaporizhia regional state administration, which was appointed by the Russian forces, he said that the program of visit is designed for just one day. And he said that basically everything which would be needed is supposed to be provided to the mission. But he also said that Russian forces which are present at the station, they are ready to show the evidence of shelling of the plant by Ukraine and to provide testimony of local residents on the territory of the nuclear power plant. And according to him, the mission, the International Atomic Energy Agency mission, should go to the nuclear power plant through the city of Vasilivka in the Zaporizhia region, and this which is at the moment under the control of the Russian forces. So they want this route to be confirmed. We don't know if this route is confirmed.
And as details emerge, Anna, we'll be sure to check in with you to learn what is actually happening there. I also wanted to ask you, because you had the opportunity recently to speak with U.S. Senators Amy Klobuchar and Robert Portman in Kyiv.
It was very nice to see the senators in Kyiv. The main conversation was about Ukrainian actions and Ukrainian counteroffensive actions in the Kherson region. We were talking about, in general, about how the senators see this and how they assess Ukrainian fight and Ukrainian efforts to in using all the military equipment provided by the U.S. and international partners. Let's listen to what Senator Klobuchar had to say.
Well, it's very clear that Ukraine has shown the world that they're not giving up. And in fact, they're going to win this one way or another. so many people had counted them out at the beginning. I don't think they expected that shopkeepers were going to...
And also about the recognizing Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. And now let's listen to Senator Portman and his thoughts on that.
We think that Russia has committed war crimes all over this country. Some of those war crimes have been publicized by you. Thank you for Voice of America, because when you are targeting civilians, when you are firing on hospitals and schools, these are war crimes. So I personally believe that these are effectively acts of terror, and that sponsorship, state sponsor of terrorism, is appropriate. But there are others who believe that's not the right way to approach this, even though they do agree that the war crimes are being committed. So we have to work that out.
Anna Chernikova reporting for us in Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Visit voanews.com/flashpoint for more updates throughout the day. Mikhail Gorbachev, who presided over the demise of the Soviet Union and helped in decades of Cold War fears, attracted the lasting enmity of millions of Russians, bitter about the chaos unleashed by the collapse of the world's largest country, died on Tuesday at the age of 91. Condolences and tributes are pouring in from around the world following his death, and VOA's Michael Brown reports on some of the early reactions.
Mikhail Gorbachev, who died Tuesday at the age of 91, is being remembered as a one-of-a-kind statesman and a giant who steered his country towards democracy. U.S. President Joe Biden said in a statement that Gorbachev was a man of remarkable vision. He said, as a leader of the USSR, he worked with U.S. President Ronald Reagan to reduce both countries' nuclear arsenals. Gorbachev helped remove thousands of warheads that threatened Europe with destruction by signing the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Reagan in 1987. In 1989, Gorbachev ended the Soviet war in Afghanistan, begun 10 years earlier under Leonid Brezhnev. Australia's treasurer called Gorbachev one of the world's most significant leaders.
The curtain has come down on one of the world's most significant leaders. He was a pivotal figure at a defining moment. When the world saw conflict and stalemate, he saw peace and possibility. He was the epitome of courage and vision, and he was a reminder that it takes more courage to end a war than to start one. And his gift looks even more remarkable in the contemporary world. There is no history of the 20th century that doesn't have him playing a central role in it. So the world mourns his passing today.
Russian President Vladimir Putin expressed his deepest condolences, according to a spokesman. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was deeply saddened to learn of the passing of Mikhail Gorbachev, describing him as a one-of-a-kind statesman who changed the course of history. Perhaps most significant were Gorbachev's economic and political reforms to the Soviet Union system known as Perestroika, which paved the way for the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. Gorbachev's diplomatic efforts earned him a Nobel Peace Prize in 1990. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said, "I always admired the courage and integrity he showed in bringing the Cold War to a peaceful conclusion. In a time of Putin's aggression in Ukraine, his tireless commitment to opening up Soviet society remains an example to us all." The ailing Gorbachev, who turned 91 a week after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February, largely let his accomplishments speak for themselves, making few public comments about the war in Ukraine or anything else. Michael Brown, VOA News.
VOA Russian service reporter Danila Gaparovich spoke over the phone with Georgetown University professor Angela Stent shortly after Gorbachev's death was announced.
Gorbachev is viewed very differently in the West and in Russia. And I think for many Russians, and particularly since Putin came to power, they blame Gorbachev for the breakup of the Soviet Union. You know, they say he was a weak leader. And so everything that he, much of what he stood for has now been reversed by Putin. I mean, he stood for much greater freedom of speech, for opening up Russia's dark pages in history, for, you know, allowing Eastern Europe to go free and Germany to unify, for a more open relationship with the West. All of those things he stood for have now been largely negated. So he has maybe a small group of followers still in the Soviet Union, in Russia, you know, people who worked for him in the Soviet times, people who respected him. But he's largely very unpopular there. He's completely not in the mold of a traditional Russian or Soviet leader. He didn't want to be, you know, a Vorsht, a great leader, a strong leader. I mean, he didn't want to be a weak leader, but he didn't want to impose things on his own people. And that's why, really, he, and to some extent Boris Yeltsin after him, were aberrations in the, you know, 1,000 years of Russian history that we can think of. And he really allowed, I mean, Russia, the Soviet Union was a much freer place, particularly in the, let's say, the last 3 years of his rule, than it's been at most other times, except in the early 90s, when things were more chaotic.
And she continued by describing where she saw Mikhail Gorbachev's place among other Russian leaders.
So he really is, he's an aberration if you look at the history of Russian rulers. Although he didn't reject Marxism-Leninism, but he was moving away from the Communist Party. So public, if you like, or the official glue that held the Soviet Union together was the Communist Party and the Communist ideology. Although by the time he came to power, most people, I think, were very cynical about that. So I think the reason why he couldn't have kept the Soviet Union together was not so much because he became president instead of party leader, but because he was willing to listen to the non-Russian nationalities in the Soviet Union who didn't want to be ruled from Moscow. I remember when he came to Washington in the early 1990s and somebody asked him at the Library of Congress, what was your biggest mistake? And he said, I underestimated the nationalities problem. So I think maybe you could have had a Soviet Union with a president going forward and a different kind of ideology. But the problem was that, you know, the 14 other ethnic republics of the Soviet Union didn't want to remain part of it.
And finally, she closed by describing her personal thoughts of the former Russian leader.
I admire him very much for, at least for the foreign policy aspects of what he did. You know, the rapprochement with the West, allowing Eastern Europe to leave, if it leaves the Soviet bloc, allowing Germany to be unified. I mean, I had an interview with him once after the Soviet collapse, when I asked him, which Western leader did you admire most? And he didn't hesitate a moment. He said Ronald Reagan. And then he said Margaret Thatcher after that. So he obviously enjoyed being treated as a peer and being respected by the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Great Britain. But I think he really did. He unleashed forces in the Soviet Union that really were quite positive. The problem was that his economic legacy was really flawed, and he vacillated between, more thoroughgoing reforms and then listening to the people who still wanted a planned economy. So his indecisiveness, in a way, also was a real problem toward the end of his time in office.
Angela Stent is a professor at Georgetown University. I'd also like to thank our VOA Russian service colleague, reporter Danella Galpovovich, for sharing her conversation. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies this week warned that a lengthy war in Ukraine will have severe humanitarian consequences for other global crises. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Devastating secondary effects from Russia's invasion of Ukraine are already being felt 6 months after Russia's invasion. International Red Cross Federation officials warned this week that the economic impact on millions of destitute people worldwide will worsen the longer the war drags on. Ukraine was one of the world's biggest grain exporters before the war. The Russian blockade of Black Sea ports, however, has prevented grain shipments, triggering a global food crisis. Skyrocketing food and fuel prices have made these and other essential commodities unaffordable, plunging millions of people into acute hunger. Earlier this month, a UN-mediated deal allowed Ukraine to resume grain exports. Nevertheless, the Red Cross says the consequences of the war continue to be felt and will take a long time to undo. Brigitte Ebbesen is International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's Regional Director for Europe. She says humanitarian needs remain acute, especially in the Middle East and Africa.
The food crisis in Africa is something that we are already reacting to as IFRC, and we are looking at in the Middle East that buying food is increasingly difficult for a large part of the population. So the ripple effects are enormous.
More than 100,000 local Red Cross volunteers and staff have been mobilized to provide humanitarian aid in Ukraine, 7 bordering countries, and 17 other countries in the region. Speaking from Kyiv, Ukrainian Red Cross Director General Maxim Dotsenko says 8 million people are internally displaced and more than 5 million have sought refuge in neighboring countries. He says the conflict is likely to go on for a long time and Red Cross staff and volunteers will continue to work to provide critical aid. He says continued support from the international community also will be crucial.
The renovation of infrastructure, the renovation of houses, the renovation of the industry will require a lot of efforts of a global community of Ukrainian people. So the needs of the civilians are crucial for now, and we don't see the tendency that these needs will be decreasing, especially in this winter period.
The International Red Cross says half of Ukraine's 44 million population will require humanitarian assistance for a long time, even if the conflict ends soon. It says it will take years to repair the damage to cities and homes. The Red Cross also says it will take years to alleviate the mental anguish, trauma, and the physical and economic suffering the war has caused. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
More than 6 months after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, life near the front line in a village in Ukraine's Donetsk region is a daily struggle for one couple and their 4 children, who retreat to a cellar as they try to hang on to their home amid the sights and sounds of war. Reuters' Lisa Bernhard has their story.
For more than a month, this family in eastern Ukraine has had no electricity, gas, or running water, but they have no plans to leave.
They shell us constantly. There is no help, no water, no food. For literally a month, they don't bring anything, not even bread. We live on whatever we've got here.
The couple, Bogdan and Olga, live in a simple house near the front line in the Donetsk region with their 4 children, ages 4 through 10, and 3 of the kids' grandparents. Olga is pregnant with the couple's 5th child. The family survive on the food they have grown, baking bread in an oven in the garden, and drawing water from a well. When the shelling starts, they take shelter in a cellar where they have stockpiled provisions.
When they shoot, well, we will sit for an hour or two here. And it happened that we sat here for a whole day, so maybe for an hour outside, but in the basement for a whole day.
But even in there, it's hard to feel safe, especially for the young ones like their daughter Mira.
I'm a little bit afraid.
Olga worries about the effect the conflict is having on their children.
We as adults at least know what to do, and the children, well, what will my son do, for example? He is 4 years old and does not understand yet, thank God, that this is war. He knows that a rocket has flown over us. This he knows, but he does not know what to do in this situation. Therefore, they constantly sit here in the cellar. When they're shelling, then we run across. We are all together with the children because we care for each other.
Still, she says the family is determined to hold on to the home they have worked hard for.
Our property is not fancy, but it is ours. We earned money to build this. Ukraine aims to evacuate two-thirds of residents from areas it controls in the eastern battleground of Donetsk, as well as other frontline areas before winter. Authorities describe the evacuation as mandatory, but residents can opt out by filling in a form declaring their intention to stay.
Lisa Bernhard of Reuters News. And finally, Ukrainians in the western U.S. state of Colorado marked Ukrainian Independence Day and 6 months of war with Russia at a fundraising event to support charities and defense operations in Ukraine. Svetlana Pristinska was there.
Six months of war continue to rally Ukrainians abroad to help Ukrainians at home. Marina Dubrova helped organize this year's independence celebrations in Denver.
Ukrainian festival means a lot for not only for Ukrainian community, which means a lot to us, just to bring unity in, within us and show the support to Ukrainians in Ukraine. It is also a big community event for our friends' communities, Americans, Polish, Lithuanians, Belarus, all those who support us in this very hard time and days of Ukraine. We didn't expect that many. We have, I think, over 1,000 people today, which we are very excited to host all of them.
We try to bring in a variety of food, a lot of ethnic food. People have been here for about 6, 7, 8 hours. Supporting the good cause.
Along with Ukrainian food, the festival included culture, history, art, and popular Ukrainian musicians.
I am American, but I have a lovely Ukrainian girlfriend, and I'm looking forward to the concert. I'm here because I want to support Ukraine.
Today we're celebrating 31st of independence in Ukraine. I really hope next year will be our victory.
Dubrova says local fundraising is buying medical supplies for civilian and military hospitals, first aid kits and clothing for territorial defense groups, and support for 3 orphanages in Ukraine.
Those kids were evacuated from areas like Irpin, Bucha, Sumy, whole Kyiv's region, Kharkiv. Also, we work with another orphanage. Kids were evacuated from Zaporizhia, but they still have kids in Zaporizhia region. Those kids with single moms, and those kids are with the cerebral palsy. So they need help there in Zaporizhia. We do help them.
Local volunteer Timson Garrett believes people in democracies should back other people in democracies.
When Putin's army attacked Ukraine in February, I really felt like I was led to do something, to be involved. I contacted Ukrainians in Colorado. I said, would you like to have a fundraiser in Northern Colorado? And they said, sure, knock yourself out. So I got engaged with them. My motivation has been, if I can help one person, then that's been worth the cause. And if it's one after one after one.
The nonprofit Ukrainians of Colorado has raised more than $500,000 since the start of the Russian invasion, with plans to continue fundraising for as long as Ukrainians need it. Svetlana Pristinska for VOA News, Denver.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. And for even more, follow us on social media. You can find us at VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C.